Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent, documentary, and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill, is an intimate documentary film, one that I'm sure that you will enjoy, and it is a compelling film, emotional film, and a film of discovery about a major musical talent. We're joined today by the co-directors of Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. That would be Brian Lindstrom and Andy Brown. To both of you, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning. How did you hear about Judy Sill? How did this become a project? Andy?
I first heard about Judy Sill from the musician Andy Partridge of XTC, talked about what a big influence she had been on him. That was around 2000, maybe, and just in an interview. I downloaded some of her bootlegs because her albums were long out of print, probably from Napster. And then YouTube started some years afterwards, and her version of the song The Kiss on the Old Grey Whistle Test appeared. And it had a very strong effect on me, as it does a lot of people who see that performance. And then maybe a year after that, I showed it to Brian thinking it would have that same effect on him, which it did. Brian, do you want to?
Yeah, and we started to bat around the idea of like, who was Judy Sill? And we tried to do a lot of research on her, which resulted in us deciding indeed to make a film about her. And we, in December of 2013, went down to LA and interviewed all the kind of surviving Judy friends that we could find. And what was really powerful for us is that they all talked about just how much fun Judy was, how much they loved her, and what a light she was. And this was really great to hear because at that time there was a Wikipedia version of Judy that, you know, was all kind of doom and gloom. And she wasn't like that. You know, she was the life of the party. She was a person who like attracted people to her because she was fun to be around. And we knew that, you know, if we could tell the story that both like kind of honored the beauty of her music, the quirky nature of her personality and how much fun she was, while also, you know, not running from the dark side, that we would have a kind of full portrait of this beautiful artist.
The thing that strikes me about her in watching the film is there is an innate intelligence, especially when it comes to music. And along with that comes this vulnerability that may not have manifested itself so much in her private life, but her music seems very vulnerable to me.
I think it absolutely manifested itself in her private life. She was very straightforward and honest about her struggles with her friends, in her journals. She didn't shy away from discussing her very difficult past to anyone who would listen. I think that was part of connected to her mission to make music that would help heal people, that she needed to be honest about herself and her own struggles in order to represent that she had been through hard times and that she understood the power music could have to heal. You know, I guess this, in some ways it's really sad and bittersweet that it wasn't enough to heal her, but she had, you know, music, making music, but she had the disease of addiction and not the same resources in those days to deal with it that might have existed now.
Brian, let's talk a bit about the world of the early 1970s, the music world, especially here in Los Angeles, which is where she comes into her own. In the film, we see some of the big names from that era, your conversations with people like Jackson Browne, John Colvin, David Crosby, Graham Nash, a whole lot of people that we'll know. But what drew her to Los Angeles? I mean, what was her muse, if you will, in making music? And how did it fit into that particular time frame?
Well, Judy was born in Oakland, but moved to LA when her father died, when she was about 7 or 8. And so LA was really her hometown, and she was an LA creature. You know, she, you know, lived in a wrecking yard in LA with her first boyfriend, Walter Fisk. And in terms of what Judy was drawn to musically, you know, I think in many ways she was drawn to survival, and music was her way to do that. Yeah. You know, she felt a deep connection. As she wrote in her journal, "I felt the arrow, I heard the signal." You know, I think she felt a deep calling to be a songwriter. And after she was able to kind of deal with some personal demons, like, you know, addiction, kicking heroin in jail, she was ready to devote herself to her music. And she did. And in 4 years, she went from, you know, kicking heroin in jail to having a billboard on Sunset Boulevard for her first album.
Well, and also, Andy, she was in an environment where the singer-songwriter was definitely in vogue, right? I mean, especially when you talk about something like Asylum Records and David Geffen, there was a real stable of very impressive singer-songwriters during that period of time, right?
Oh, yes. And she was the first artist signed by David Geffen to that label. He recognized how well she would fit into his idea of what Asylum would be, which is this place where an artist, singer-songwriters, bands as well could have be in a laboratory where they could develop their skills and from album to album. So yeah, I mean, I think she fit in nicely with that group, but her music was very different as well. It's not the typical Laurel Canyon sound, as far to my ears, it's not. It's more connected to, well, as she described it, gospel, country, baroque, I'm leaving one out, country. It combines so many more influences than I think a lot of the other artists there. Not to put down those artists, but just it doesn't sound to my ears the same as Crosby, Stills and Nash and the Eagles, let's say.
Right. Well, you know, we see that clip from, is it called Old Gray Whistle Test, that yes. Particular program. And seeing her and hearing her, it almost feels like that folk era of the British, sort of that time of the British, where there was a lot of groups that were playing English folk songs or Scottish folk songs. Yeah, yeah. It kind of felt like it was in that vibe with the Baroque. And I mean, I'm just, you know, from my own ear, I think that may have been.
It's possible she was influenced by that, but I'm not sure that was her main, what she listened to most. She loved Bach. She loved Aretha Franklin. She loved doo-wop. She loved Ray Charles.
Yeah.
So she loved classicals. Fauré.
Yeah.
Gabriel Fauré, the great classical composer, was one of her favorites. So.
But what's interesting, Mike, is when she attended LA Valley College as a 19-year-old in 1964 or 3, she won the songwriting contest there with her first known recording, which is A Poor Tender Maiden's Lament. And just a few notes into that song, you recognize it's Judy. Now, even at that age, there's a fullness to it, and you know who you're listening to.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I just want to quickly remind our listeners that we're speaking with the co-directors, that would be Brian Lindstrom and Andy Brown, of a terrific documentary film called Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. And it's about an artist who you may have maybe heard of, but probably not, but a wonderful performer, wonderful writer, and a very complex story, personal story to go along with it. And the influence that she is having on some of today's artists is also explored in the film. The storytelling itself, the recordings of Judy. I mean, this must have been a fairly long journey to sort of find all of the different material about her, right? Let's get into just sort of the sleuthing needed to uncover so much of what you use in the film and her own voice and the journals. I assume these are actual journals that we see in the film of hers. Is that?
Yes. From the beginning, we wanted Judy to tell her own story in her own voice as much as possible, but we were up against the paucity of archival material. So this was a puzzle we had to figure out. And we were lucky to find an audio recording of Judy giving an interview with a journalist named Chris Van Ness in 1972, where she basically told her whole life story. So suddenly we had her voice. And that was such a eureka moment for us because it solved a big problem. Then we got access to her worldly possessions, which were in a box that her cousin had. And in that box were her journals and some of her drawings and many of her drawings. And she was a very talented artist. And those drawings became the basis. Well, so the journals allowed us to construct a voiceover for the last years of her life from 73 to 79, which a voiceover actress reads.
Yeah.
So we have Judy's voice for the first part, And then it's a voiceover actress named Sonia Gotti, who's reading the other parts. And the style of the drawings became the basis of the animation. So it was as if Judy were creating the animation. That was our goal. And then lastly, we got the multi-tracks for Heart Food and her posthumous third album, Dreams Come True. So we were able to have Judy score the film as well with those multi-tracks. So that became, that's partly why the film took so long to make, because it took a while to accumulate all those materials. But luckily we were able to get them.
Well, I love the way the story is told. And I love the fact that we tie together the past and the present in the film. I think opening it up with, was it Robin Pecknold from Fleet Foxes, beautiful voice, the way it's staged. It's just a beautiful way to introduce us into her music.
Oh, thank you so much. We felt so lucky when we got that footage of Robin and because it gives the film a present tenseness, you know, it shows that Judy's legacy is alive and thriving. And we really felt like we wanted the film to have that kind of energy to it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I really appreciate it. It is going to be opening in theaters on April 12th, as well as on, is it Apple and Amazon at the same day as well, right?
That's correct. Yes.
But here in LA, it'll be opening up at the NoHo up in the North Hollywood Lemley Theater on the 12th as well. And a whole bunch of other places being released through Greenwich, a releasing distributor, terrific outfit to be with. They've had so many wonderful documentaries about musicians in the past. So it's good to see that you're with them. And any reaction? Have people been coming forward to you and the screenings that you've been a part of, where people are talking to you about her or about the effect her music has had on them? Ryan, or you get?
Yeah, there's just been this feeling of like, you know, Judy fans will come up to us and just be so delighted because they get to actually, in some ways, meet the person who's inspired them so much.
Our film premiered at Doc NYC in November 2022, and it streamed limited at that time as well. And a lot of the fans of the Judy Sill Facebook group watched it, and their reaction was pretty positive, which was a great relief because they're a tough crowd, but they seemed to like it overall. So that was a nice threshold to have met, I'd say.
Well, Well, congratulations. I am a fan. I can't wait to hunt down Heart Food and her first album. I'm looking are they available?
Oh, Spotify, Apple, everything. Yeah.
Is there a hard copy anywhere? I mean, can we get
there's vinyl. I believe there is vinyl. Okay. But both. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Who's reissued it, but yeah.
Very good. I wouldn't be surprised if it was like Rhino or somebody like that.
Rhino did the reissues, but I don't know if they did vinyl, but some other entity did like an 180 gram version of it or something. You know, I forgot who, but not too long ago.
Yeah. Well, thank you for a complex and I feel like a wonderfully, a great overview of Judy's life, her music and her, and the world that she lived in. And thank you so very much. Again, you're very welcome. The film is called Lost Angel, The Genius of Judy Sill. We've been speaking with the co-directors, Brian Lindstrom and Andy Brown. Thanks, guys.
Thanks again.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.